If you felt stuck trying to lose weight, you're not alone. Enter Weight Loss by Hers. It's designed to support you in reaching your goals. And Hers now offers access to an affordable range of FDA-approved GLP-1 medications, including the Wegovy pill and the Wegovy pen. With Wegovy at Hers, lose up to 20% or more of your body weight when combined with diet and exercise. It helps you regulate your appetite, eat less, and keep weight off. Plus, Wegovy is the first GLP-1 available in a pill, so there are no needles needed. Everything is 100% online through Hers. You'll connect with a licensed provider who will determine if treatment is right for you. If prescribed, your medication is delivered right to your door, no insurance necessary. And it doesn't stop there. Weight Loss by Hers goes beyond medication by offering access to 24/7 messaging with your care team and tons of in-app lifestyle and nutrition tips like recipes, meal plans, fitness videos, sleep content, and more. Even better, with a range of affordable GLP-1 options, Hers makes it simple to find an approach that fits your needs and your budget, if eligible. You'll get a treatment plan personalized to you and unlimited dosage changes as needed. It's weight loss designed to work with your life. Ready to reach your goals? Visit forhers.com/women to get personalized, affordable care that gets you. That's forhers.com/women. forhers.com/women. Weight loss by Hers is not available in all 50 states. Wegovy is the registered trademark of Novo Nordisk AS. To get started and learn more, including important safety information, Wegovy clinical study information, and restrictions, visit forhers.com.
Welcome back to Misunderstood. I'm your host, Rachel Yucatel. I'm so excited about this next guest today. You do not have to be a sports fan to find this interesting, guys. Okay, he's a retired NBA champion whose 14-year career included the Golden State Warriors, the Los Angeles Lakers, and the LA Clippers, just to name a few. He's a leading voice on social justice, a proud father, successful business owner, and the host of the podcast All the Smoke. Please welcome Matt Barnes to this show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So I mentioned to my ex-husband, Matt is his name also, that I was talking to you today. And he is a huge sports fanatic. He knows everything about sports. I know basically nothing about sports. And I asked if he knew who you were. And he's like, of course I know who he is. And he's like, but Rachel, you know, he's really hot-headed. And I said, really, why do you think that is? And he's like, oh, you know, well, it's really crazy that he's so hot-headed because he's had it so easy his whole life. I thought that was a really interesting comment. And I said, what do you mean he's had it so easy? He's like, well, he's played for the Lakers and he has a big paycheck and all this stuff. And I wonder if you get that a lot. Do people misunderstand your past?
Definitely. But I'm to the point now at, you know, I just turned 43 yesterday. I necessarily don't mind people who have an opinion on me that don't know me, because everyone's going to have an opinion, whether it's warranted or not. I leave that to them. That's not my issue. But, you know, I had a very rough childhood. Both my parents were functioning drug addicts. I grew up in abuse, violence, drugs, bounced around as a child. But luckily, I was someone who was able to, you know, turn all those negative things that happened to me in my childhood as fire to continue to motivate me and keep an edge about me that allowed me to live out my dream and win a championship and now be a father and do a ton of other stuff that I never thought I'd have the opportunity to do.
Exactly. So that's exactly what I wanted to get into, because I think it's so impressive who you've become. I wanted to get into your pre-MBA career and talk about your childhood. What was it like growing up as, in a mixed race household?
I didn't really have any issues with the mixed race until I moved from the Bay Area to Sacramento. My mom being a full Italian, my dad being African American. It was never an issue when I lived in the Bay because it was very diverse multicultural, a lot of people who look like me. When we moved to Sacramento, because of some street stuff my dad had got into, although we moved to a neighborhood that was similar, and when I say this, people kind of look at me crazy because I'm half Italian, but my parents started putting me in all predominantly white schools, 95, 97, 98% white. And I never understood, or like, why can't I go to school with my kids in the neighborhood? Or why can't I go to school with my basketball friends? And my parents just weren't having it. They always put me in white schools. And I think they probably thought it was because it was a better education to give me a better opportunity to succeed. So I found when we moved to Sacramento and I started getting put in these white schools, that's when the biracial issue kind of started happening. And it was the first time I was around predominantly white kids. And, you know, the word nigger started coming up a lot. And I wouldn't understand, because I'm third grade this time, so maybe 8 or 9 years old, why these kids wouldn't let me play kickball, wouldn't let me play wall ball, wouldn't let me play foursquare, wouldn't let me play basketball, wouldn't let me play nothing with them ever, ever. And, you know, it was just, it was really frustrating, and because it was the color of my skin. And then some of them started getting brave enough, like I said, to start actually calling me nigger. So it was my first time, about 9 years old, starting to really experience racism. And as a 9 year old, you're heartbroken and confused, because, you know, I never really saw color or understood color. Because like I said, where I first grew up, everyone, you know, was similar to my tone, and color never came up. We just all played together. But so I would go home and, you know, be disheartened and probably sometimes crying. And obviously my mom would do the mom thing and kind of shelter me. But my dad's like, no, you have my permission. If they call you nigger, you can fight them. And I'm like, oh, so now I have permission. So from there on, it wasn't something I was proud of, but it was a means to fight ignorance. And I had to face it at a young age. So starting in third grade, I started fighting. Every time someone said that, they would have to pay for it. And that lasted probably third grade, a little bit of fourth grade, and then kids stopped. And, you know, they started accepting me, and I excelled in a bunch of different sports. And, you know, to this day, I still have friends from third and fourth grade. And although it didn't start well, I could say 30 plus years later, it's great.
Talk to me about what happened at Del Campo High School. There was a mannequin hanging from a noose there. How did that affect you? What happened there?
I was a senior, so I was about 3 months away from going to UCLA, and my sister was a sophomore, and there was a kid that just kept harassing her. And it kind of started off mild, and it continued to get serious. And then he started throwing racial slurs at her. And, you know, I would never be able to see the kid because I never saw him. And then one day he called her nigger and spit in her hair, and it was right before class got out. So as soon as class came out, she came and found me because I was done for the day and she still had another class. You know, I was about to go home. So she and two or three of her girlfriends come up to me, tell me what's going on. I still see the spit in her hair. And this kid just, unfortunately for him, happened to walk by. So, you know, as a big brother, I did what I was supposed to do and protect her and send a message. And I did that. You know, got taken to the principal's office after that and explained what happened. Again, spit still in my sister's hair. And this man sat in front of me and told me, no, I don't believe you. You know, his dad's a prominent lawyer in the city. He wasn't racist. And he, obviously, this kid's over here crying because I just put hands on him. But he's just like, I never said that. And I'm not like that. And you know, again, I'm a 5-star athlete in football and basketball. I have scholarships to every school in the country, you know, and I'm about to literally leave for UCLA. And it's just like, I'm not on bully time. Like, I'm literally protecting my sister. So they didn't see it that way. I get suspended for a week. Probably 3 or 4 days under my suspension, the KKK comes and vandalizes my school, burns down bathrooms, swastikas everywhere, die nigger. They hung a mannequin. We had a big oak tree in front of our school, and they hung a mannequin in the oak tree with my football jersey on it that said die nigger. And that changed me. You know, again, I was very proud to be up to that point biracial. I had faced some racism when I first got to Sacramento, and then, you know, nearly 9 years later at 17 or 18, I faced a huge, obviously, obstacle. And that was for the first time in my life where I realized, although I'm very proud to be Italian and Black, that the world saw me as a Black man. So not only did they vandalize my school, we later found out that there was a hit on my life. So I had to move to a different neighborhood. And we had around the clock security for about a month, provided by the NAACP. And it was just a unfortunate situation. And again, up to that point, I had such a great time in high school. Still one of the greatest times of my life was being in high school. But it really hurt me that after all that hard work I had put in as a student, all the hard work I put in as an athlete, you know, lettering in three different sports and winning league championships and doing all this thing, the one time I really needed the school to understand and hear where I was coming from and have my back, they didn't. So that, again, that was a kind of a wake-up call and a harsh reality of the world we live in. But again, mm-hmm. instead of using that as something to cry about or pout about, it just, you know, just added fuel to the fire. And, you know, I just kept that tucked away and, you know, went on with my college career.
Did they ever catch those kids?
It was weird. It's crazy you ask that question, because obviously the one kid that I got into it went to school with me, but they said he didn't do it. But someone literally just told me that it was four guys and three out of four of them are dead now. Two overdoses and something happened to another one. And then they don't know what happened with the fourth kid, but it was crazy because like someone literally just told me this like a month ago, because obviously have never forgot it, but you know, I don't let it weigh on my mind, but someone sure. literally just told me about a month ago that three out of the four kids that were responsible are now passed and they don't know where the fourth guy is.
Wow. Crazy. So, all right, moving on. So you ended up going to UCLA after that. Yeah. And what was next for you there?
UCLA was amazing. It was really my first time kind of out of a small town. You know, I was in Sacramento from 9 to 18. And, you know, just a small, slower moving town to throwing into Westwood, which is Hollywood, you know, Hollywood borders our school. So I went from, you know, they call Sacramento a cow town to basically Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But it was amazing. Just the opportunity to go to UCLA with all the tradition and the history. And actually, my first year at UCLA was 1998, and there was an NBA lockout. So there was no other basketball being played besides our basketball. So we used to have like Shaq and Kobe and all the LA stars that, you know, movie stars that you would see at a Laker game. They started coming to our game. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is what college is like. This is what UCLA is like. So it was an eye-opening experience. It was an amazing mm-hmm. experience. And again, 4 years at UCLA was some of the best times of my life. Have friends still to this day from there that I talk to daily, opened up a lot of doors, and you know, it provided me an opportunity to have a chance to play in the NBA.
Right. So you started, let's see, with the Clippers. Was that your first team?
Yeah. So I bounced around early on. Second round pick who got cut, started in the G League. Played well there, got an opportunity to play for the Clippers, and then kind of got on this carousel where played well enough to stick. But then, you know, my first 4 years, I wasn't given very many opportunities to actually show what I can do. And, you know, there's so many guys in the NBA, you know, the average career is three and a half years. So, you know, I'm coming up on year four and not really getting an opportunity to play, and just hoping for that opportunity. But at the same time, you know, my brother is an up and coming football star. Football is my first sport. I was the number one football receiver in the country my senior year. Mm-hmm. So I kind of started thinking, all right, well, if this basketball thing doesn't work out, maybe football does. So the mm-hmm. summer going into my fourth season, I'm doing basketball training in the morning and football training in the evening. Because not really knowing what was going to happen, what opportunities would present themselves. My agent at the time had found about six or seven NFL teams were willing to give me an open tryout. So I told them that I wanted to give basketball one last shot, which I had a training camp opportunity coming up. And I said, you know, if this training camp opportunity doesn't work, let's try to jump to football. Thankfully, that opportunity was with the Golden State Warriors in 2006. And it's a 15-man roster. They had 17 guarantees already and 20 guys coming to camp. So literally I was the 21st guy coming to camp. And, you know, the coach, let me back up a little bit. So I got called. I was living in Sacramento at the time in the offseason. And a former UCLA teammate of mine, Baron Davis, said, hey, you know, we're having an open gym if you want to come by. So the Bay Area is about an hour and some change from Sacramento. I drove down there, played really well, not knowing the head coach was watching the whole time. So after we get done playing, head coach comes down, puts his arm around me, like, "Hey, son, you know, how you doing? Like the way you played today. What are you doing this season?" I was just like, "To be honest with you, I don't know. You know, camp is around the corner. I don't really have any offers." He's like, "Well, hey, you know, I can't promise you a roster spot, but I promise you, if you come and compete like you did today, I'll give you an opportunity." So again, there's 15 roster spots. They already have 17 guaranteed contracts. So they already have to cut two guys, and they had three more guys in camp. So I came in camp, played really well, and found my way to a guaranteed roster spot. So that was in the 2006 season. And although I came in the NBA in 2002, 2006 is when I really felt like I got my first opportunity to show that I can play this league. And, you know, when that opportunity was given, I didn't give it back and ran with it. And from there is really why I felt like, you know, year four, year five was where I felt like, okay, I'm in here now, and now I can make some noise. So, you know, after that season, played well and was able to just maintain contracts for the next, I guess, 10 years after that.
So then you went from there to the Suns, then to the Magic, then you were with the Lakers. How was that?
The opportunity to play with the franchise. Some people look at it like, you know, hey, you know, for instance, you know, Kobe was able to play 20 years with the Lakers, and that's, you know, that's everybody's goal. But at the same time, I realized early that wasn't going to be my path in this league, and I was okay with that. So I just took every opportunity as a opportunity, understanding not only is it a basketball opportunity, but at the same time, I'm going to these teams and I'm always playing, I'm always starting, or I'm always the first guy coming off the bench. So it's also business opportunities to start meeting the people who are sitting in the front rows of these games, because those are normally CEOs, business owners, you know, all kinds of different opportunities. So I started thinking then, let me just meet these guys. Let me shake their hand, because I was, you know, like your ex-husband thought, you know, I was labeled the bad guy, and I was okay with that. But at the same time, I think when I'm able to show people who I really am, they're pleasantly surprised, like, "Oh shit, like, you're not a thug, you're not this, you're not that." I'm just like, "No, I'm just, you know, I came from a rough upbringing, but I have a degree, educated, and I'm just a competitor." And so I was just always kind of surprising people when I would meet them, and, "Well, here, give me, you know, take my number down and, you know, come to the office. So let's go to lunch." And it was just people really started kind of taking a liking to me. And again, use those opportunities from playing for different teams to meet different types of people in different types of fields. And, you know, just kind of carried on through that through my career. Obviously, being a Laker was a dream come true. I was a huge Laker fan growing up. And there's an infamous moment kind of in basketball aura. And it was just the 13-year anniversary the other day. I think it was March 7th, 2010, where I got into it with Kobe. And I faked the ball in his face, and it went viral, and it's still viral 13 years later. At the end of that season, so the Lakers go on through the finals. We play the Boston Celtics in the Eastern Finals. I'm in Orlando at that time, and we end up losing. So the offseason, the Lakers beat the Celtics in the finals. So that offseason, I'm a free agent, and I thought I was going to stay in Orlando, but then they weren't really offering what I thought I was worth. So I started talking to the Miami Heat. And out of nowhere, I get a call from a number that I don't recognize. And if you know me, I rarely answer my phone. Even if I see the name on the phone, I'm just not a phone person. I happen to answer this call, and it's Kobe. And at first, I'm like, "Yeah, right. Who the fuck is this?" He's like, "Nah, it's really me." So he and I, you know, kind of start talking back and going back and forth. And, you know, I was congratulating him on winning the championship. And he asked me what I was doing next year. And I kind of told him, you know, like, "Hey, you know, I'm talking to the Heat and the Magic right now." And he, you know, he's like, "What do you think about being a Laker?" And I'm like, "What do you mean? What do I think? I mean, Lakers are my favorite team. It'd be an honor." He's just like, and he literally told me, he's like, "Anyone crazy enough to fuck with me is crazy enough to play with me. I want you to be a Laker." And I was like, "Shit, I want to be a Laker." And literally 4 days later, I was a Laker.
Wow. Yeah. That's a great story. So, all right. So after the Lakers, you went on to play again for the Clippers. Uh-huh. So talk to me about that for a little bit, because most people know about Donald Sterling and that whole saga. But for people that don't know about that scandal, I'm going to let you fill them in a little bit on that, because they just know about V. Stiviano, I think. What was it like, first of all, working for Donald?
It was interesting. I mean, obviously, Donald had a history of discriminating against minorities. You know, he's a big real estate guy out here in LA, and just kind of had a history of discrimination.
But was he like that with you personally?
No, not at all. Like I said, I never had any issues. Always respectful. You know, I was always respectful to him. When I saw him, I spoke. I was actually more kind of friendly with his wife, Shelly. Shelly was very nice and kind and always, you know, stopped me out to come talk to me and ask me how things were going. Mm-hmm. So when I signed there, I'm not necessarily thinking about Donald Sterling. And I don't think, you know, Chris Paul or Blake Griffin or DeAndre or anyone else on our team was necessarily thinking about Donald Sterling. Mm-hmm. I think what we were thinking about is the Clippers have been the doormat of the NBA pretty much for their entire existence. We have a really good team and we feel like we can change the narrative on this team. Mm-hmm. We felt like we had a championship type of team and we definitely did. And we took a lot of pride in trying to, again, remove the stigma from the team. You know, the Clippers were the doormat of the NBA. And for the first time in their franchise history, we won the Pacific Division title, 50 plus wins, one of the best teams in the league for about a 2 or 3 year run. And that kind of came boiling to a head. Was it 2015, I think, where Donald Sterling was caught or was recorded by his side chick.
So, timeout. Did you used to see V. Stefano at the games?
No one can stand this. I mean, I don't even like talking bad about people, but just no one liked her. She thought that she owned the Staples Center. She thought that she, you know, she was a part of the organization. She used to walk around and strut like her shit didn't stink, and just no one liked her.
They knew she was the mistress.
Everyone, he used to sit her courtside of games while he was sitting with his wife. He would just sit her somewhere else. So it wasn't a secret. And I'm no one to judge because at the time I wasn't perfect and I haven't been perfect in my relationships, but it was just blatant, wild, outlandish disrespect. And I think she fed on that power too. Like she liked people talking about her and she liked kind of being the center of attention. So I say all that to say that kind of came to a boiling head first round of the playoffs that year, where she recorded him saying some, you know, unfriendly and racial things about minorities, particularly Magic Johnson. Mm-hmm. And that she released the tape to TMZ. And we're in the midst of a tough battle against a young Golden State Warriors team. So to put it kind of in context, we end up beating this Warriors team. But that next year is when they went on their dynasty run and they won 4 championships in the next 8 years. So this is a young, we knew at the time, like, hey, this team is next. This is the young Steph Curry, young Klay Thompson, young Draymond Green. They're a young, hungry team. So this tape is, you know, launched in the middle of a playoff series. And we're like, fuck, like, what are we supposed to do? And so now everyone's telling us. And this is kind of the beginning of social media, kind of not just being showing off your money or what you're doing, people are kind of starting to speak out against things, particularly athletes. So now we have the whole world, you know, telling us what to do. Or you guys shouldn't play and your owner is racist and you guys are, he's treating you guys like slaves and this, this and that. So now everyone has an opinion on what we should be doing. And although we agree, you know, we felt that, you know, obviously what he did was wrong. And again, with my past, I knew he was wrong, but it didn't really bother me. I'm just like him saying nigger or him saying this or him saying that, like that doesn't bother. Like I almost lost my life. You know what I mean? So this is, you know, this, the way people talk or people think, like I was just thinking to myself, like he's not the only owner that thinks this way. He's just the only one dumb enough to get recorded doing it. So again, it just kind of puts a strain on our team. You know, some people want to sit out. Some people want to play. If we do sit out, does it kind of as a loss? How long do we sit out? Is he going to be fired? So there's just so much unknown that we just decided to try to play through it. Fortunately enough, we were able to play through it. We were able to beat the Warriors. But then I just think his dark cloud was looming over our team constantly. So it became less about basketball as we continue to win and just more about what was going to happen to Donald Sterling. Like, how does he still have this team? And everyone's outraged. But at the same time, although he was the one that messed up, people are starting to get mad at us because we keep playing. But we're trying to tell people, like, yo, we're not playing for this man. Like, we're playing for the people in our locker rooms, our family, our friends, our fans who believe in us because we feel like we have a team that can win a championship. So just a lot of other stuff kind of caught up with us. We ended up losing the next round. And I think the NBA was kind of happy about that because, again, the narrative the whole time while we were playing was just a negative narrative of Donald Sterling. And obviously, Mr. Silver, the commissioner of the NBA, fresh on his job, ended up banning him from the NBA. His wife, Shelly, pulls some strings and ends up getting the team sold to Steve Ballmer. and kind of the rest is history.
Yeah. So how do you think things have changed in the NBA in the last decade?
From that standpoint, I just think people are using their voice more. You know, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, the whole, you know, young Black kid, you know, Trayvon Martin movement with the hoodies. And I just think from that point on, and I think the Sterling situation was kind of the beginning of the floodgates of athletes really stepping into their own and using their, not only their voice, but their platform as a call for change, a call for attention. And since then, there's been no going back. You know, again, I think the NBA is kind of at the forefront of social movement, and they do the best they can. I don't always think they do the right things in some, but I think their heart is in the right place, trying to figure out how to, as such a multi-billion-dollar, you know, conglomerate, how do we do what's right, considering that majority of our players are African American. So I always take my hat off to the NBA because they do try. They are progressive. They're at the front of the line of change, and I have a lot of respect for them for that.
Speaking of that, you've gotten, you really use your voice now. You've gotten involved in a lot of political stuff. You talk a lot about Black Lives Matter. I mean, talk to me about the things that mean a lot to you right now.
The Black Lives Matter movement, I wasn't necessarily with that movement from a standpoint of, yes, I think Black Lives Matter, but I think the business behind the Black Lives Matter mantra got a little messy. And funds were misappropriated. And I hated that it kind of gave a black eye to the movement, no pun intended. Because again, I think, you know, black lives do matter. Black people's lives do matter. But I think, you know, when the money started pouring in and these people really didn't have no idea what to do with it, they started doing some stuff they shouldn't have did with it. So I'm to the mantra of, you know, the movement was great. I think the people we are standing up for were great. But I just think, you know, money got to those people's heads, and, you know, I definitely didn't agree to that side. But from a different standpoint, from just, you know, I try to use my platform to speak up for those who don't have a platform or those who don't have a voice. I think I've been misunderstood my entire life, about who I am or what I'm about. And, I'm someone who made it out of circumstances that a lot of other people didn't. And I realize that I'm very fortunate for that. So now that I do have the opportunity and the means, I try to help. I try to give back. I try to motivate. I try to educate. And not to say that I'm perfect, because I'm still making mistakes along the way, but I'm continuing to learn and try to better myself every day. You know, I got interested in politics. You know, Kevin Johnson, who was a former NBA player, was a mayor of my hometown of Sacramento. And to me at the time, it wasn't so much about the political side of what he was doing, but I just really saw him making a difference in the neighborhoods, cleaning the neighborhoods up, you know, providing opportunity for the youth in those neighborhoods. And it really kind of motivated me to think, like, damn, if he can do it, why can't I do it? So started shadowing him, you know, still in contact with the current mayor, Mr. Steinberg out of Sacramento. And again, I just turned 43 yesterday, and I gave myself a goal back in my 30s that by the time I turned 50, I wanted to run for some sort of office, whether that be mayor or governor or whatever it may be, just because I think it would be different. It would be refreshing. It's not something that people expect. But I know that I can make a difference. So I say all that to say, I still have a handful of years. I still got 7 years, before, you know, that time is up. But, I do more than anything, whether I end up, you know, taking on that challenge that I, you know, gave myself 10 years ago or not, I just want to continue to show people hope, give people opportunities, and inspire the youth, because I feel like in our communities, you have to see it to believe it. Most of the time, these kids look up to who they see, and they see guys on the block doing all the things they shouldn't be doing. So I always want to be a symbol of hope, of someone who made it out of tough circumstances, and to motivate other kids, to let them, male and female, to let them know they can too.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of kids, you have a number of children yourself. You're an amazing father. We'll get to that in a second, but you were very close with your mother, who unfortunately died of cancer. Talk to me about her death and how that affected you.
Yeah, my mom was super mom. You know, my dad was out doing what he needed to do, provide for our family. So our mom was everything. would go without eating to feed us, make sure we were always clothed and homework was done and ready for school. Again, I was born in 1980. And if you know anything about the 80s, everyone pretty much did drugs back then. And my parents mm-hmm. were no different. But I think, you know, what I was blessed with was they were able to still function while they were doing that. So we were always fed. We were always clean. We always had clothes on our back. We always ate. Our homework was always done. So although I can go to school and you would never know what was going on at home, it wasn't always sweet at home. So my mom did her best to try to make ends meet and be super mom. And unfortunately, she was diagnosed with four cancers, all in stage four, November 1st, 2007. And she died November 27th, 2007. So within 26 days, she was diagnosed and she was gone. And it was tough. Because obviously her being my best friend and my rock and my confidant and, you know, my drinking buddies at the game, like she used to come to the games and she'd be in the bars with us after the games, taking shots and hanging out and kind of almost a team mom in the NBA, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really happen. But she was just always full of great energy and such a vibe that, you know, losing her so fast was difficult. And it really affected, obviously, my family hard, but I didn't know how to take it. It was, I don't know. As much as she meant to me, I never cried from her death. And I don't know why. I don't know if it turned me numb or if it just, it did something to me where, I don't know. So it's been, my mom died and my twins came almost a year after that. So my twins turned 14 in November and it was the 15-year anniversary this past November of my mom being gone. And obviously think about her daily. The pain never goes away. I just tell people, you know, over time you learn how to manage the pain, I guess. And, yeah. You know, continue to try to, you know, do right now because now she's always watching. You know what I mean? Yeah. So anytime I'm doing some shit, I'm thinking like, ah. I know my mom's watching this. So it kind of, you know, it keeps me a little bit on point as well. So, you know, anyone who's ever lost a parent, particularly your mom, it's the most devastating thing you can go through.
Yeah. I lost my father too. And it was when I was 15 and it was devastating. And it's interesting you say that because I did not cry for a very long time. And I think that maybe a year later, I was taking a shower. And it hit me because I think I was alone and it was just the most odd place. And I, out of nowhere, I just started sobbing and then it stopped. And to this day, I kind of don't deal with it. Do you know what I mean? And it's very odd. And once in a while, something will happen that'll trigger it, like a song or something will happen. But, you know, I really keep it inside of me. It's interesting that you say that.
Well, I think it's tough. I mean, there's no rhyme or reason or any method on how you grieve. I think everyone grieves differently. You know, my brother and sister, you know, I saw my mom literally zipped up in a body bag and it gives me chills to this day. And it's just like, there's no way you know how to deal with that shit. You know, no one teaches us how to deal with that. So to me, I just think everyone mourns different and I respect, you know, the way everyone decides to mourn. But yeah, we definitely have similar, you know, takes from our situation because obviously they meant so much to us. But for some reason, I still, 15 years later, have never let that big cry out. So if it's coming, I welcome it. If it's not, well.
And did your team help you kind of get through that?
Absolutely. Team was great. The organization was great because at the time, again, I was playing for the Golden State Warriors. So that's an hour and some change from Sacramento. So daily I was driving to see her in the hospital. They let me miss practice, let me just come to games. And then when she finally, you know, when she did pass, they were very supportive. They came to the funeral. The entire organization came to the funeral. And really that's where my co-host and I now for All the Smoke, Steven Jackson, became brothers. He had got traded to our team February of 2007, and we made a historical NBA run where we were the eighth seed. We beat the number one seed for the first time in NBA history in the 7-game series. So the very next season, the season starts in November. My mom's diagnosed November 1st, so I'm just kind of out of it. And Steven Jackson was the one. I mean, obviously everyone was very supportive, but Steven Jackson was the one constantly calling me, checking on me, bringing me food, coming over to smoke with me and watch TV. So he was really kind of just my rock. So from there, we went from, you know, competing against each other and becoming teammates to becoming brothers and the best of friends to this day. Again, you know, we have an award-winning podcast together now, but that's when he and I's real connection started, was when I lost my mom.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So now talk to me about fatherhood.
Awesome. You know, I had a rough childhood, and I always told myself, and you know, when I would pray, that if I ever had the opportunity to be a father, I would be the best dad possible. And I was blessed with the opportunity to have twins off the rip, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. Wasn't necessarily ready for that. Don't think I went from having no kids to two kids right away. And the kid part wasn't necessarily hard. It was just obviously having a partner now, you know, a real partner, you know what I mean? Because at that time, their mom and I were up and down. You know, we were young. She was 22. I think I was 26 or 27 when we got pregnant. I'm in the midst of kind of just starting to break out as an NBA player. And it was just tough. And then all of a sudden, bam, I got two baby boys. So the fatherhood came natural, came easy. To this day, what I'm most proud of is being a father, but just learning how to parent and then co-parent when her and I divorce, and then maintaining and understanding, although we're going through our BS, that the kids are still the most important thing. And I think that's hard for a lot of people. Now, unfortunately, more, you know, there's more blended and broken families than you know, mom and dad have been married for 30 years type stories. Those are rare. Those are rare these days. So, you know, we're like pretty much everyone else where, you know, we have a blended family now. So the twins are 14 now and amazing. And I get a chance to coach them and see them all the time and father them. And they're just growing up too damn fast. And then I have a 4-year-old who thinks he's 14 as well, has a vocabulary of a 14-year-old, which is not a very good thing, that I have with my fiance. And then my fiance has 3 children from a previous marriage. So we have 14-year-old twin boys, 11-year-old daughter, 10-year-old son, 8-year-old son, 4-year-old son. So we have 6 kids from the age of, age of 4 to 14. So we're the Black Bradys over here. But is it always easy? No. Is it worth it? Absolutely. Does it stress me the fuck out sometimes? Absolutely. But I love it. You know, I mean, and the fact that, you know, I remember growing up with my brother and sister and playing with them and fighting with them. And I just know those are some of the fondest memories I cherish. So now that we have 6 and there's yelling and fighting and screaming and good times and bad times, I just know it was something, you know, these kids will always remember, you know, as they continue to grow up. So I embrace it. If I need to get away and get into my man cave and lock the door and get some quiet time, you know, my fiance allows me to do that. And again, fatherhood is the best, if you can even call it job, best job in the world.
All right. Talk to me about Hybrid TV. You're the CEO of this company. Tell me what that is.
Yeah. So Hybrid TV is just kind of a platform for cannabis. And in all walks of cannabis, not just, and obviously I think we've come a long way in the cannabis space, but it's not just, you know, the old Cheech and Chong narrative of getting high every day. It's, you know, cannabis is used in so many different forms in cooking, in health, in fitness, in fashion. So we just wanted to provide or create an opportunity for people to come and display their content on our platform with no red flags or yellow tape. So we're in the process of fine tuning the final tweaks of it, and hopefully we'll be launching the platform soon. So I just kind of call it like a Netflix for cannabis people. And again, it won't just be cannabis only. It'll be music. It'll be sports. It'll be culture. It'll be fashion. It'll be cooking. It'll be exercise. It'll be so many different verticals within the cannabis space. So I'm really excited about this project.
Okay. And on your podcast, it's All the Smoke. You guys are known for smoking pot on your podcast. Yeah.
sometimes. So it didn't start that way. So, you know, my partner and I, just real quick, how it kind of started. We were both retired working for ESPN and Fox. And, you know, I still work for ESPN to this day. And that's obviously a Disney company. And although I appreciate the opportunity, you know, it's not 100% who I am. I can be that person. I can be in that lane, but I wanted to create something where I felt a little more comfortable, a little bit more laid back, and a little bit more relatable to our people. And came up with this idea, partnered with Showtime right off the rip. But we know Showtime at the time was just like, you know, we can't smoke weed on TV. I'm just like, well, shit, our show's called All the Smoke. Fuck you mean? Like, you can't smoke weed on TV. So the first season we didn't. But the first year of existence, we won Sports Podcast of the Year. So they gave us a little bit of leniency. So we kind of started sneaking it in here and there and with certain guests. And I think the first guest we were able to smoke with was Snoop, which is obviously very fitting. And then from there, we kind of just realized, okay, we can smoke, but we have to smoke with people. It's okay. So obviously, we have a Steph Curry or a Kevin Durant. They're current NBA players. We can't smoke with them. But if we have, like, we just had DJ Quick, the legendary DJ Quick, is the episode we literally just dropped yesterday. He's a music guy, you know, and he wants to smoke. So we smoke with him. So we kind of pick and choose now who we smoke with. But I think the show All the Smoke, and that doesn't necessarily mean physically smoking. We wanted to bring you the heat. We wanted to bring you unfiltered, unscripted, real raw conversations with some of your favorite people. And we've been very fortunate enough to be able to create an atmosphere where we get the best of the best and the biggest of the biggest. And, you know, my goal has always been to humanize these people. Like, I'm fortunate enough to know, you know, to know these people, but I want to show, you know, people, you know, for example, rest in peace to my brother, Kobe. I want to show people the other. I wanted to show him, you know, not the mom, but I want to show him Kobe was the father, the businessman, that side. You know, everyone knows Snoop's a great rapper, but what is Snoop like as a grandfather now? What kind of business stuff is he doing? So on and so forth. So I always just wanted to kind of show our fans the other side of some of their favorite people. And I think we've been very successful at doing that. And I'm having a good time doing it.
Who was the best interview you think you had?
Man, that's such a hard question. I mean, I think, obviously I'm going to say Kobe because first of all, it was a great interview. It was supposed to be a two-part interview. And then unfortunately, you know, he passed, you know, two weeks after the episode dropped. So Kobe was a great episode. Snoop was fun. Kevin Hart was fun. Jamie Foxx was fun. I mean, you name it, we've had them. I just think all of them are so unique in their own way. It's kind of hard to pinpoint like that one. I'm so fortunate to be able to do the things I do in my post career because I wasn't an NBA all-star. I was a role player. And I think the reason why I succeeded is because I realized that early on, like, yo, you're not a star. All right. Well, be the best role player, be a star in your roles. Like, I was a star role player. And I think that my realness, in the game was respected after the game. You know, now in the media space, it's so much about disrespecting and hot takes and trying to go viral. And I've just never been about that. I feel like if you know enough about a sport, you can have a quality conversation and within that conversation, you'll have some great moments. So I just think my realness from who I've always been has been accepted well in this next phase of my life. And I'm able to have an award-winning podcast. I'm able to work for ESPN. I'm able to work for the Sacramento Kings and the Clippers. I'm able to start a whole network for cannabis users. And there's a lot of other cool stuff I'm doing. And I'm just so thankful to be giving the opportunities that I've been given because sometimes guys that were stars don't even have the opportunities that I've had. So I'd never, you know, never take any of that for granted.
You guys recently had Will Smith on. I saw the episode. I thought it was great. Obviously, I think a lot of people tuned in because they wanted to see what he said about the slap.
It was unfortunate because Will was that was my first time meeting Will, and Will's someone when I first started the show, I was like, damn, we need to get someone like Will Smith. And then lo and behold, you know, season three, we're able to get Will Smith. But right from the jump, Will, we shook hands, and you know, he acted like we've known each other forever, which is such a dope energy and environment. And when I tell you, Will explained to a T what he was thinking, what he did after, and how he's been healing, it was unbelievable. But of course, the team didn't want that. It was too real. It was too real for them. You know, it was too real to be released. So unfortunately, we only got to show what everyone saw. But when I tell you, he gave us an in-depth encounter, step by step, from what he did from the time that happened, the what he read, where he traveled, who he talked to, who he leaned on. It was unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. But unfortunately, you know, we were kind of one of his first coming out interviews because it was right before Emancipation. And his team, his village, you know, thought it was a little too real to be released. So I have the unedited version, and I got a chance to watch that, and it was just like the whole narrative, the everything would be if we got to show that. I don't really still think. I mean, obviously Chris Rock just did his special and talked mm-hmm. about it, and probably that would have kept the energy going. But if we could have released what Will said when we had it on the show, I think it would have changed the narrative about what's going on right now. Because even after that episode, his team is just like, yo, Will's never opened up like that to anyone. He's never felt so comfortable. He's never spoke so freely. Thank you guys. It was almost like therapy for him. And we felt so special and honored for him to even, that's Will Smith, the A-list. I don't care how many people he slaps. It's the A-list, you know, it's Will Smith. So we just felt fortunate enough to be able to, you know, be there in the moment and experience the moment. And I guess that conversation was for the moment. But I just wish it was for the world, because I think it would really change a lot of people's opinion on what happened.
Yeah, it was obvious you guys had some great chemistry for sure.
Yeah.
Do you read the comments section of social media?
I do sometimes. And I have been someone known to fire back at times. But I just think, you know, the more and more great opportunities that are coming my way, I realize it's just a test and I have to allow people to have their opinions. Sometimes it's hard, especially when they're way off. But at the end of the day, their opinions aren't changing my blessings. They're not changing my day-to-day life. They're not changing the money I make. So I just have to allow people to have the misconceptions or the ideals about me or with the way I move and come to the realization that's their problem, not mine.
How do you feel about the private lives of public figures? Do you, some people think that everything is fair game. Do you agree about that?
It just depends on what situation you put yourself in. And I don't ever try to make myself seem like I'm an A-list celebrity, because I'm not. I think probably at the best, I'm a C-list. But I also opened up my world in reality TV. And when I did that with my ex-wife back in 2009 or 10, it's never been the same since. And I don't even say it in a bad way, but it's just nothing has been private. Obviously, my divorce was very public. Anyone I dated after that was very public. But it also opened me up to a whole new side of viewership and people who don't necessarily know anything about sports. But I could still get people to this day coming up to me, women, oh, I remember you from the reality show with you and your wife. And I'm just like, oh, okay, that's what's up, man. I hope you enjoyed it. You know what I mean? So it wasn't all bad. It got me into wanting to create content. Obviously not content like that trash, but just quality content. But again, it just opened me up to a whole new eyes of viewers and more fans. So we live in a world today where nothing is really private. You got to try to keep it private and keep it as sacred as you can. And if it is public, you're going to have to work that much harder. So I don't think there's any secret to, you know, there's no secret recipe. You know, we all know relationships are hard, whether they're public or private. But when they're public, it's a little harder. So, you know, you just have to make sure you're on the same page with your partner and prioritize your mental health and your happiness and do the best you can.
Okay. And the last thing I wanted to mention was Athletes Versus Cancer, your organization that you created for your mom. Will you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I started that organization the year after she passed. And, you know, I just didn't want anyone to go through what we had to go through. So in the past, we've done, health clinics. We've provided information. We've paid for funerals, medication, hospice, you name it, just anything kind of related to cancer. It's kind of sat dormant for the last 3 years because I didn't really have a solid direction, but my team and I have been putting something together. So we want to kind of start a scholarship program for kids who beat cancer that want to move on to college. So I'm in the midst of developing that platform right now. And, hopefully we'll be able to, you know, do some good with that.
Okay, great. And I think you have an event coming up, right? Wednesday, June 28th. You're going to be hosting a celebrity golf tournament at Pelican Hills Country Club. Is that right?
Yeah. So I teamed up with Boxing Wags, Deontay Wilder's wife, the former heavyweight champion, Telly. They do an annual golf tournament. I went to it the first year. I used to go do a golf tournament with my event. So I just asked, you know, do you guys want to team up? And we've been able to team up. So right now we're just kind of getting the dirty work, trying to get sponsors, trying to get people, you know, kind of the grind side of the event. But I'm excited about the event. I have no doubt that it'll be a successful event and it'll be for a great cause. So people be looking out. If you see this and you're in the California, LA area, I'll be posting information on it shortly and we would love to have you.
Great. Awesome. Thank you so much, Matt. I so appreciate everything that you've given me today. So I wish you the best of luck in everything you do.
Thank you for having me. And tell your ex not to judge books by their covers until he opens and reads them. All right, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Misunderstood podcast with host Rachel Yucatel, executive producer Kelly Brink. If you have an episode suggestion or would like to reach out for collaboration and sponsorship opportunities, email us at infomisunderstoodpodcast@gmail.com. That's infomisunderstoodpodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Be sure to like and subscribe everywhere you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and review because it helps the show so much. Watch full videos of each and every episode of Misunderstood on YouTube at Misunderstood Podcast. See you next time. Misunderstood.